left off last week, we were trying to finish up Babylonia, the Babylons, going back over these world powers. We're reminding ourselves of not only the atmosphere that was in place when we go into this time period between the Testaments, but it's allowing us, too, to go back through some of these instances and remind ourselves and go back through Scripture, or at least the references of all that God put in place before that time period. Likewise, when we get on the other side into the New Testament side later on in the quarter, we'll see all that's there from before. So it's a good thing to spend some time on. I know it's kind of a lecture type thing to go through this history on these nations, but it gives us a lot better feel for what the children of Israel were going through, what laid ahead, how much God gave them in preparation and warning about what was going to happen, in detail of what was going to happen. And it reassures me, it's been encouraging to me to see that God has never left them lacking or not knowing, and He's never left us needing to know anything. We've known our history as well. We stopped when we were talking about the Babylonians. We stopped, said we would talk a little bit about the religious and the social part of the Babylonians. The gods that the Babylonians had as far as religiously goes were a whole lot like the Assyrians. And if you remember when we looked at the Assyrians, they were very... They had a whole lot of gods. Gods, they saw gods in a lot of things, and the Babylonians were a lot like that. They were very, I guess you'd call it, superstitious. They realized, you know, and knew that there was greater powers around them. However, we know it's been a long time since the flood up into then, but we see that how little was passed on to them from Noah and from those times, and how much was lost and what they had came up with in the way of gods. But they were very superstitious. They had a creator that they called Marduk, and they had a spirit of the water that was Ea. That was a couple of their gods. Funny thing is, they looked at most of their gods as a threat to them. They saw them as something that would hurt them. They feared them for the most part, except for the god Ea, which was that spirit god of the water or whatever. And they liked it because they were a very prosperous, wealthy nation because of the water, because of the trade that they had. The water, you know, they used water for their trade, and they put a lot of faith, I guess, in that God is a good God. But for the most part, they saw them as evil gods. I know the sea trade that the God brought in really caused them to flourish, and that was what I was looking for, was the trade route that it provided. It was why they liked it. They believed that the bad gods, the evil gods, they couldn't keep them out. They described them as snakes that slithered through the hinges of the doors or whatever. A lot of their architecture showed these hideous, horrible, ugly, scary figurines on both sides of their doors, entry doors. They thought that scared away or kept some of the bad gods away. They believed in witches and demons. Put a lot of faith in the stars. Been a long time since I was in school. Vaguely remember a little bit, but it's been, you know, considered by man that astrology was born in Babylonia. They were one of the ones that at least looked at astrology, looked at the stars, to the point that they, you know, they felt they could foretell future. They could read those things and predict the future from them. They built a lot of temples. They called them ziggurats or something to that effect, the way it's spelled. And these temples that they built, seemed from ruins and stuff that they found, a lot of their temples were very similar to what they would have seen from the Sumerians. Not the Sumerians, but the Sumerians. That was an old group, an old civilization that was before them. They had towers in these temples that they had. A little smaller. Each tower is a little smaller. Kind of a stair step, stages-like, that these temples had. The most famous one was in the city of Babylon. It had every stage had a different color as it went up. Black, orange, red, gold, pale yellow, deep blue, silver. And each stage was dedicated to a different celestial or heavenly body. Saturn, the sun, Mars, the moon, all these things. They had a stage that was dedicated to those things. They held constant services at these temples that they had scattered out. They had a New Year festival that lasted 2 weeks. That was a big one for them. But these things went on and on and on. One of the interesting things that I noted in this study when I was looking at it, the seventh day was kept as a day of rest. And through all that chaos and all that, you see, seventh day was a day of rest. Can't help but make you wonder, you know, by looking at their gods, we see that they have refused or failed to hand down through their generations since the time of Noah who God was. But you get all the way back up here in these days and you see the seventh day as a day of rest and you wonder, you know, where'd they get that idea? I wonder if that came down, if they did hang on to that, but they believed in life after death. However, life after death was a gloomy, dismal, ugly thing and a place of no return, they considered it to be. And for the most part, their religion had no bearing or effect on their conduct or their behavior. It was just gods that they worshipped and whatnot, but as far as influencing them or guiding them in their behavior, that was not what religion was about to them. Some interesting points was in socially, moving on from religion to social matters. Socially, they as conquerors could be as cruel as anybody in their time as far as the way they handled militarily and their conquest that they were on. We know they utterly burned and destroyed Jerusalem. Many other walled cities happened. 2 Kings 25:4-7, Jeremiah 39:1-7, God records for us there how they handled King Zedekiah of Judah. We see where when he was captured that they made him witness or watch in front of him the killing of his sons and his administration. Right in front of him, and when that was over, they blinded him and then put him in prison for the rest of his life. So we see that, you know, they were cruel, or as cruel as many that were around in a way, but they didn't seem to take sport or glory in being cruel. Like the Assyrians did. The Assyrians, you remember when we talked about them, they were ruthless, known to be ruthless. They held nothing back. The Babylonians, although they could be rough and ruthless, they didn't glory in that. They took a different stance as they took their captives. They tended to leave everybody that they conquered where they found them, as long as they would accept Babylonian rule submissively and they didn't have any problems with it. A submissive city, a lot of times when Babylon took it, would be left intact. Of course, it was required to be under their rule and it was required to pay tribute. But it seemed like as long as they were willing to do that, Babylon was willing to leave them in place. You know, in the case of Judah, we know her cities were destroyed and all the destruction that came with it. But she was one that rebelled and would not fall into place, so Judah was handled a little bit differently. We know in certain instances that the captives were treated quite generous, even in the case of Daniel and his companions. We know that they were taken away. They were placed in, you know, captivity. But what did they do? You know, they lived in the king's palace. Many of those that were taken there were in service to the king. It lived in a luxury. They were given positions of authority, even power. They were allowed, the other Jews, the regular Jews, who they moved out, they were commonly moved out, the tradesmen or the ones that they felt could be a threat to them, out and relocated them, dispersed them like they did with Judah. But even the ones, the Jews that they brought out and replaced, they were allowed to establish their own colonies in some areas. They were allowed to have jobs. They were allowed to prosper. Some of them were prosperous. They had colonies along the river Chebar, which was an irrigation canal that stretched from Babylon to Erech. And in that, you know, they were allowed to colonize, prosper. Might remember in chapter 29 of Jeremiah, when he wrote that letter to the captives, and, you know, he told them to the sons to plant, build houses, plant gardens, marry, and to prosper, because Babylon allowed them the atmosphere to be able to do that in. And many Jews became fairly prosperous during that time. So you see the way they handled them was not all bad, as long as you were submissive and you paid your tribute, you didn't get out of line. To bring some of the players that we're familiar with into context, politically, Babylon, this Neo-Babylon Empire, if you remember last week we touched on that. If you look at Babylon, the Babylonian Empire is so old. It started way back. So, you know, it went through a lot of changes, a lot of ups and downs, and the latter, you know, around 626 B.C. or something back in there, up closer to this time that we're going to hit in between the Testaments and the time that the Jews were there, that time period on, it's considered Neo-Babylonian Empire. Nabopolassar was the founder of the Neo-Babylon Empire. He came along later. His son was Nebuchadnezzar. So you see, we start getting into some familiar names here in this latter Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, was considered their greatest king. He expanded the borders of their country, probably the greatest. He built Babylon into the most glorious city on earth. If you'll remember, last week we mentioned the Hanging Gardens and all the things that are mentioned and given to us to give us an idea of how opulent and great these cities were. They were beautiful. They were polished. They were really refined, beautiful places. And Nebuchadnezzar also, he was the only king to this time that ever destroyed the temple of God. Truly, God allowed him to rise to a level unsurpassed. I mean, he was the king of all. But you know, even through all that, we can't help but remind ourselves that God never let him believe that he was the greatest. He did have an attitude problem from time to time, but we know from the history that God records for us, God kept him in his place. And many times through his dreams, through his visions, through Daniel's interpretation of those, and through his own admissions, through many of scriptures, he recognized God that was over him and that he served at God's will, more or less. We read a lot about him in Daniel 2, Daniel 3, Daniel 4, a lot of those scriptures there that covered Nebuchadnezzar a lot. When God struck him down with the beasts of the field and whatnot, and that he was kept in check. Following him was evil Moradet. We find him in 2 Kings 25:27. That's going to get us up around 560 B.C. He was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't last long. He laid a couple years, and his brother-in-law killed him, Nergal-Sharezer. Read about him in Jeremiah 39:13. That got us up to about 556 B.C., and then Labeshah-Marduk comes in 556 B.C. He got deposed pretty quickly, too, by an uprising. And following him, a general that had served under Nebuchadnezzar came into power, Nabonidus. He was probably also a son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. And then comes Belshazzar, the son of Nabonidus, grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And he was appointed as a co-regent with his father. And why he's so important, you know, we read him, we see a lot of him in Scripture. Both he and his father ruled Babylon until it finally fell to the Medos and the Persians up to about 539 B.C. So we're creeping up very close to the time that we're going to hit here that's in between the Testaments. And we see where this Medo-Persian influence comes in. God gave us a lot about them, about their coming. He predicted it. He warned of it. His plans that he had to bring this Medo-Persian up, to take down Babylon, to start the process of getting the political atmosphere and the social atmosphere that they were being held in primed and ready for a return of his people from Babylon. So the Medo-Persian Empire was very important for this event that was coming up. Persia was an ancient world empire that flourished from about 539 all the way up to 331 B.C. The Babylonian Empire fell to them, to the Persians, and that's what set the stage, as we said, for the Hebrew people to return to Jerusalem, 538 to 445 B.C., following their captivity there with the Babylonians. See a lot of references, and there's some written down here, to the nation of Persia and its representatives. Ezra 9:9 refers there. It's referred to the kings of Persia. Ezra 6:14 cites Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes, all that were kings of Persia. You know, God is making his people aware of who and what is coming, what's going on. Daniel speaks of the kings of Media and Persia in chapter 8, verse 20 of Daniel. Daniel 10:13 mentions the prince of the kingdom of Persia. And the book of Esther refers to the powers of Persia and Media in chapter 1 and verse 3. It refers to the seven princes of Persia and Media in chapter 1, verse 14, and the ladies of Persia and Media in chapter 1, verse 18. Probably the one that probably sticks out to us or remember the most is in Daniel 5, verse 28, where it's prophesied there that Daniel prophesies that Belshazzar's kingdom is going to be given to these Medes and to these Persians. So God has given us all this to show us that he's in control. He's playing this out through his own plans. He's given timelines in many cases. To really understand this Medo-Persian Empire, you know, it's refers to two, Medo and Persian. You need to really look at both these individually and then put them together, which will put us in a time frame that we're familiar with Medo-Persian. If you look at Persia, the Persians apparently sprang up from a people from the hills of Russia known as the Indo-Aryans. As early as 2000 B.C., That's way back. We're going way back again. They began to settle in Iran and along the Black Sea coast. Two of these Indo-European tribes settled on the Elamite border and to the east of the Zagros mountain range. The first references that we see made about them are in inscriptions that came from Shalmaneser III, the Assyrian king that we've discussed before. That's all the way back 800 and some B.C. There's mention of them there. They're noted as the Parsua, or the Persians, and the Medea, or the Medes, in those transcripts. The first mention of a Persian chieftain refers to his role as an ally when he teamed up with Sennacherib of Assyria, back when we were talking about these alliances where they were getting together. You start seeing this Persian chieftain mentioned. His son was called King, Great King, King of the city of Anshan, and his grandson was who actually fathered Cyrus II, which is important to us. Cyrus is. He was the most celebrated king of history, Persian king. He's actually who defeated the Medes as a Persian and brought this Medo-Persian thing together. And he's very important because of how he played with the Jews when they come in and the Babylonians are relieved and they're getting ready to go back. In Isaiah refers to him as my shepherd. Chapter 44, verse 28. He's also referred to in Isaiah 45, verse 1, as his anointed. Isaiah was making the prophecy and showing that this was God's doings. It was God that was placing him there as a shepherd. He's placed him there as a tool of his anointed, his rod that he was going to work through. This media, this other side of the term, was an ancient country of Asia situated west of Parthia, north of the Persian Gulf, east of Assyria, and Armenia, and south of the Caspian Sea. It's where we know right now Iran, Iraq, Turkey, that little area there. That's where the Medians came from. It's a mountainous country. Media contained some fertile sections, but most of it was cold, barren, and swampy. But it did have a lot of good, fertile bottom land because they were world-renowned for their horses. They had a cavalry, which was very instrumental in their ability to rise to power as they did. God allowed them the tool of the horse, the thoroughbred, to rise up to power. So they did have lush plains and all that that they used in their cavalry. The Medes are a hard one if you go back into history and study very much about, because they had a very complex background. As we mentioned last week when we talked about the alliances that they teamed up together at these different times, Media was very active in alliances and teaming up with other powers. They would ride to the top with someone and then fall down, and they were up and down as all the other countries were, mostly depending on what time in history that you hit them in. The Medes were an Indo-European people who invaded the rough mountain terrain south of the Caspian Sea, we're told. The Assyrians conducted campaigns against them, forcing them to pay tribute in the 9th and the 8th B.C. Time period. The mighty Tiglath-Pileser that we covered a week or two ago invaded Media and added part of it to the Assyrian Empire. So they were under the Assyrians like everybody else was practically for a while there. And by 700 B.C., Isaiah would have been active, would have been prophesying, they had a very prosperous realm. They pretty much established themselves at that time. Media is first mentioned in the Old Testament as the destination to which Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, deported the Israelites from Samaria to. Around 721 B.C. You find that in 2 Kings 17:6 and 2 Kings 18:11. So they were under his power at that time, Syria was, and they deported the Israelites to that area. Medes are mentioned in Ezra in connection with Darius when he did the search, when he had to conduct that search for the roll of the decree that allowed the Jews to return to the promised land. He was the one that was instrumental in going back for that and searching for that, because, you know, Cyrus had already put that in place to happen. So they had to go back and find that. That's Ezra 6:2. We see a lot mentioned about the law of the Medes, and it came into play into some of what God gave us in our history, because the law of the Medes were laws that were passed that couldn't be changed. And we know in the history of the Hebrews there, as they come up, that was instrumental in how laws were put into place that the king himself couldn't change. They mention these law of the Medes in Esther 1:19, Daniel 6, verse 8 and 15. And Daniel prophesied that King Belshazzar's Babylonian kingdom was going to fall to these Medo-Persians, as we mentioned a while ago in chapter 5 and verse 28. Interesting note from these Medes, they don't ever go away. I look back and think on it from what you see. They rode the powers up many times. They were powers themselves at times. They played the game. They were good at it. We go all the way over to Acts 2 and verse 9, and who was there in Acts 2 and verse 9? They were many there from all over the world, we're told. And Medes were one of the countries that we see there that people were from there in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 and verse 29. So whether it's referring to them as an area that they come from or whatever, they're mentioned there. About 710 B.C., Sargon II of Assyria defeated the Medes and forced them to pay tribute. We mentioned that. They had to give up their horses for the most part. The Medes, however, increased in strength and joined forces with Babylon again. And the Medes under Syraxes and the Babylonians under Nabopolassar captured the ancient city of Assyria in 614 B.C., kind of how Assyria came to an end. They were instrumental in teaming up with Babylon on that and getting rid of Assyria. They overthrew Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, in 612. And that's what caused their crash. Nahum mentions it in chapter 2, verse 3, and chapter 3, verse 19. Nahum mentions that, and he makes mention of the great relief that the countries around had when that Assyrian Empire fell, because, you know, as we've studied and looked at, they were savages, they were horrible. Everybody was glad to see them go. So Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar, that Babylonian, he married this Cyrus-Xerxes' daughter, this Mede's daughter. And that's what strengthened those two countries together, too, during that time. During the end of Nebuchadnezzar's time, or during the era of Nebuchadnezzar, in the time of Jeremiah, which is going to get us up 602-552 B.C., this Median kingdom reached the height of its power. So when Jeremiah was prophesying, that's about the time they reached their power. At that time, they dominated Persia until Cyrus II came in. Remember, he was the important one. He's the one that puts the decree in first. He joins the Medes with the Persians. This law, this Median law that can't be changed, you know, all that comes into play with it. But he comes into the empire in 549 B.C. The Medes and the Persians remained for a long time. They're mentioned together in Esther 1:19, Daniel 5:28. We've got the expression mentioned in Scripture of the laws of the Medes and the Persians. And it was mainly mentioned because of that unchangeable aspect of it, to where the king was powerless to even change it. They had to deal with that in Esther, in 1:19. But when Cyrus II brings them together, that's when we get the Medo-Persian Empire as one. That come about that time, 549, 559 BC, Cyrus II comes in to power. He's got them together now. He's conquered the Median king. He's defeated Lydia, Babylon, established the Persian Empire. The last conquest is referred to in Daniel 5. But it's easy to see that Cyrus's rule, his power, was a sovereignty of God. You see how God orchestrated this up to a place, and he employed this power to put these two together under Cyrus, to not only be able to defeat the power that had the children, or had the Jews, but to bring a power that could defeat them and release them. It's no doubt God reassures our faith in that he's in control of all things. Cyrus was a humane, partly because of the gods that we talked about, or we will talk about. They had gods that were good and gods that were evil, and Cyrus, hung to this good side. He was benevolent toward most of the people that he defeated or he took over. He was the Persian king, that issued, of course, the decree to restore the Jews to their homeland following their long period of captivity. 2 Chronicles 36:22 through 23, Ezra 1:1 through 4. Cyrus is the founder of a lot of systems. Each province or Persian territory was governed by an official who answered to the great king. He put some of those things in place. He allowed freedom of religion and customs and states, including Palestine. He developed roads, cities, postal systems, legal codes, and treated the subject nations kindly and humanely. He improved on some of that had been put in place before, but he was a big advocate of that. And this is all evident. It's evidence of why God had him in the position he was in, and how he played out through this. Just as Assyria was used, to conquer Israel as a rod of correction or anger from God, God brings another power in that will release them, that will allow them to return. He's referred to Cyrus is in favorable terms in Scripture. Isaiah 44:28, Isaiah 45:3. It's not like any of the other rulers that they ever had. The son of Cyrus, which is Cambyses the second, he reigned after his father, and during his reign, Egypt got added, even to a already great empire. Some of the Greek historians, Herodotus, recorded that Cambyses accidentally wounded himself with his sword or committed suicide in 522 B.C. And after him came Darius I, the other king that we're familiar with in Scripture, more so familiar with in Scripture, which came in from 521 to 486 B.C. Darius I wasn't a direct descendant of Cyrus, but he was of royal blood. He defeated nine kings. He expanded even further. He united the Persian Empire by using coinage, state highways, postal systems. He improved on what Cyrus had started. He was able to improve on that and bring that to an even greater thing, and that allowed the empire, as a matter of fact, to expand. We'll start back next week, and we'll finish this up real quick. There's not very little left on the Medo-Persians. And then we'll go into a short lesson or two, and we'll look at some of the, we're going to look at the Greeks, some of the other influences that came up through the Greeks, and then a little bit of the Romans, because we got to get on to what came into place under the New Testament. So we'll try to shorten that down and move on through it, but we'll start there next week.